This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Toni Todd is a Las Vegas-based author, actress, and activist, celebrated for her evocative stories about passionate women and lovers obsessed with them. Her work explores the complexities of relationships and desire, and Toni's new book, 52 Love, Weekly Love Lessons in Bite-Sized Bits, beautifully explores intimacy in all its complex and expansive forms. Committed to fair representation, Toni champions marginalized voices within literary and cinematic communities. She served 4 years education chair for the Henderson Writers Group and continues to coordinate their Dying Grinds program, which connects authors with the public through monthly meets and greets. Toni is also, I suppose she finds the time, co-editor and contributor to Comics Lit Volume 1, co-host of the Fairmind podcast, and leads Banned Books Conversations, an anti-censorship series available on her YouTube channel. Thank you very much for joining. It's very early for you. Thank you for making the effort to get ready for us.
Happy.
God, pleasure. So I did want to start, if it's okay, take you back just a little bit and understand who you were in your formative years, what were you like growing up? Were you always very comfortable in who you were and what you wanted to achieve?
No, not at all. I was painfully shy. I used to cry every day. I was so sensitive. I never really felt like I was, enough, if that makes sense for you. I would hide behind my work. You know, I was straight A student, always getting high marks, but socially I was so awkward and just could not handle interactions without being embarrassed or feeling like I was just so sensitive. You know, I was a really, really sensitive little girl. And I, even into adulthood, when I first started writing, I would go to critique groups and I would hide behind my pages, shaking while I was reading. But, you know, it's very vulnerable to be up there sharing your work. And it's really been acting that has helped me kind of come out of that shell and empower some of the characters that I've played that have helped me to be able to do things like this, like have a conversation with you.
Do you know why you were so shy and reticent as a young woman?
I don't know what the, you try to unpack that over the years. Part of it is I grew up in an area where nobody else looked like me. So I think that may have been part of it. I was really awkwardly tall. In third grade, I was the second tallest kid in my school, which did not make me very popular with the boys. You know, I was much taller than all of them. And I wasn't very pretty. I was a really unattractive little girl that people could not tell whether I was even a girl or a boy, and then being a giant on top of that. So, I just had a lot of unfortunate situations as a kid where people picked on me for my teeth, for the size of my lips, for my hair being frizzy, and just for the fact that I was black. So I used to be much darker too. I don't know what happened over the years. I've kind of been drained of my color, but perhaps my affinity for vampires has taken over my real life. But I was very dark, so people picked on me for that. It wasn't considered attractive, and I was a tomboy, so very, very boyish and not pretty at all.
when did you look in a mirror and realize that you were beautiful?
I don't know that I've ever had that thought.
I knew you were going to say that. There must have been a point where you thought, actually, no. Yeah. And
I have seen pictures that I think have made me look the way some people say they see me. I've never been comfortable calling myself attractive. Like, it has always felt weird. And I say that knowing that it's healthy to say that you're beautiful. It's healthy to say that you love yourself. But because of my childhood, it's always been difficult for me. So I need to, do a better job of practicing what I preach.
Do you think it's some of your early childhood and adulthood that really drew you to storytelling, in particular, I guess, both reading and writing about powerful women and desire as a power?
So I used to write stories about strong little girls. And that kind of grew into me writing stories about strong women. But one of my favorite stories that I wrote as a kid was about a she-wolf. Like, it was not even actually people, but it was a young she-wolf who kind of overthrew the patriarchy, even though I didn't understand terms like that. But that's what it was. She grew up and she fought the mean man wolf and took over and led her wolf clan to better days. And that really is one of my favorite stories, even though I didn't understand the patriarchy or anything like that. But clearly I was feeling some of it if I was channeling it into a story. And in telling that, I don't know, something you said triggered. I do have an answer for your question. The first time that I could look at myself and say that I was beautiful. I have a niece who looks a lot like me. And when I look at her, I think she's absolutely gorgeous. And I wish that I, number one, looked like that when I was her age. And then also, how can I look at her and think that she's beautiful, knowing that she does look like me and not have, it's like A plus B equals this and B plus C equals this. So how does A not equal C, It's one of those things. So when I look at her, I feel beautiful because I see the same characteristics in her. Like, I've posted pictures of her beside me on social media and people think that it was me as a little girl. Thank you for helping me get to that.
That's a special answer. I've had lots of questions over the years, and that's a special answer. I'm glad that she helped you feel that. And I'm sure she is a beautiful young woman and will become as beautiful adult as you are. Yeah. Margaret, so when you write your stories and you create your characters, what are the main attributes you want your characters to have? What is it that you would say defines a powerful woman or a powerful half woman, half wolf, half woman, half vampire? Okay. What is it? What is it that we sort of say powerful women or women that own their...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And desire, what do we mean by that?
I would say a woman who has her own agency. She takes responsibility for her choices in the world. She doesn't look to others to solve her problems and She goes for it. Right or wrong. You know, I'm not saying that they don't make mistakes. Life is messy. But owning their own power and owning their own agency and making their own choices and moving forward through their story rather than allowing someone to pull them through it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's really interesting to say that, because I was in a conference a little while ago. Promotion or the next job, if you like. So, you know, it's all corporate world.
And women have had to prove that they can do things versus having things handed to them. And it's not that all men have things handed to them, but historically, you could say whatever you want on your resume, and you're probably going to get the job, whereas women have to have all of these credentials to prove that they have a right to be in the same space as someone who just says, I can do it.
Yeah. That's not great, is that?
No, it's not.
And they do these experiments where they send off two resumes that are exactly the same, but, you know, one of the man's name on, one of the woman's name on, or the leave name off altogether. Yeah, and it's the same with people ethnic backgrounds, etc., they associate their name with something that was written on the paper.
Right.
Which I've seen that we were getting better. But political challenges in the US. You might have heard about them.
Maybe.
Challenges and some of the almost mandated pushback. What does inclusion look like on the page or on stage? What do you look and feel like?
Oh, like ideally?
Yeah.
It means that anyone watching a story or reading a story can find themselves in that story. That it isn't watching a movie and going, oh, hey, there's a black person in this movie. That shouldn't be notable. It shouldn't be notable that there are people of color in a movie, or that there are queer characters in a movie, or that there's a disabled person in a movie. It should just be representative of the world in which we live in, unless the story that is being told has something to do with the absence of a certain kind of person. I'm not saying that there isn't room for creative reasoning, but if it's just a contemporary story, or even a story, like historically, there were people of color in Europe, but when you read books and look at movies, it indicates otherwise. That they were there.
They were. I mean, it's not something that forms part of our education, school, etc. But there were, and I think lots of English or British people, European people, would be very, very surprised. It sounds ridiculous that there were people of color fighting in the Second World War. It was always portrayed as almost a white war. There wasn't anybody of color in the war. But there was a huge amount, thankfully. They pulled us out of the fire many an occasion, but it was almost, very, very. There was a program on television the other day, and the highest military honor in the UK is called the Victoria Cross. And it was talking about this person of color who got the Victoria Cross. And you could see the audience were like, that doesn't sound right. It was odd that I guess that's 80 years ago now, but it doesn't feel that long ago, but it was still, there was still a lot of implicit segregation here. And certainly people were, It is very, very unusual to see somebody of color in certain environments, certain situations, but when it comes to fighting alongside somebody, I mean, literally, the color of somebody's skin doesn't matter when the bullets are flying.
Right. We're all the same.
Yeah, it's odd. Like you say, that all those people have existed in different countries for centuries, and we just don't see them in history books, don't see them in films, and not represented in an inclusive way.
So we're working on it. We're working on it. And even if things are the way they are right now in our country, there are those who are working to battle it. You know, like creativity is a form of resistance. And as long as we keep telling stories, there will be the legacy of what happened now. Like the way that people who write historical fiction really find the details is like in the letters that were written, in the newspaper clippings, the articles that are there. So, let's say they burn all the books. There's still a record. There are ways to find this information. Like you look at some of the laws against homosexuality. That is evidence that it was happening. People try to say that wasn't a thing back then, but it was, or there wouldn't have been a law against it. You know, you look at cross-dressing laws. Why would there be a law for something that wasn't taking place during that time?
I think there's I think maybe 45 years ago in the UK, it wasn't possible in terms of legal definition to rape your wife. 45 years ago, as a husband, you had, I'm sure what the right words are, the right to
do whatever you wanted with her body.
Yeah, so you couldn't. You might be done for assault, worst case. But generally, it was that there was no such offence as rape or sexual assault of your wife, because that was almost your chattel in a way. No, this is I can remember this. It is not I'm not that old. I can remember this being the law. It seems extraordinary that it took so long to go out the books. But like you say, people might deny that, but the statute had to change to make that something more recognisable. So just in terms of writing and acting, do you find it possible to say which you prefer?
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long distance relationship, becoming a first step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Definitely. I prefer writing 100%. I love acting. I love bringing stories to other people in that way. But if I had to choose, it would be writing, because writing is the thing that I can't live without. During the pandemic, when everyone was at home, I still acted in 3 projects. There was the very first screenplay that I participated in, the first time I ended up co-writing a screenplay, which I had never written a screenplay. It was with a director that I work with a lot, a writer and director I work with a lot. We were scheduled to do a feature film. I was starring in it. And then everything shut down. The world shut down. We couldn't do our film. And she was so depressed. And I told her, well, why don't you use this time to write something that people can film at home so that we're still being creative? We're probably not going to make any money off of it, but we're still channeling our creative enterprises. And she's such a great writer. And she's like, okay, I'll do that, but you're writing it with me. And it was, okay. And we did it. And it ended up being filmed all over the world. Someone from the UK was actually one of the actors in it. And I think it was really cool because it was talking about what was going on at the time. We're trying to date online. That was the premise of it, is trying to date online when everyone is secluded. And so the writing process, that was the thing that got me all excited about it. And then when it came to film, it was like, oh, now I am responsible for like all of this part. You know, it's different. No, there was no one directing me other than myself. But, you know, I will say I did 3 acting projects during the pandemic. I did a whole lot more writing during the pandemic. And it was, I felt guilty about how enjoyable that time was. You know, it's for a horrible reason. People are dying. There are terrible things happening. But here I am thriving creatively because I have all of this time that I could apply to it. And even when I am, let's say, on set, so I couldn't write that day, I have things going on. It's like, all right, let me get my phone and just put this note aside. Even if I knew I would never get paid for writing again, I would still write.
What is the process of writing look like? Are you a writer that says, right, I'm going to write from 11 till 3, I'm not going to leave the room until I've got 1,000 words written down? Or you want somebody that it sparks you whenever it sparks you, and like I say, just making notes on your phone? What's your, it sounds very academic, your sort of writing process? What does writing feel like for you, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask?
I do make time for it. So I'm very rigid with my schedule. I tend to have my schedule done ahead of time, like the night ahead of time. So I already know what's on my agenda for the day. I don't have to wake up and think, what am I going to do? Sometimes just starting is paralysis for people. So I have eliminated that by making sure that I already know what is on my agenda so that I can get up, get myself ready for the day, and then start. And I used to do so many projects for other people, you know, like I do a lot of activism. I do a lot of volunteering. I help a lot of people with a lot of things. And for a while I wasn't writing. And so I got so depressed and didn't know what, you know, I didn't realize at the time, it's because you're not writing, like you're not doing the thing that feeds your soul. And once I started putting my writing first, I think I may have mentioned earlier before we started the call, I'm not really a morning person, you know? So why would I think to put my writing first? I used to do my writing at night all the time, but it was getting to the point where I just had nothing left. I had nothing left to give it. But now that I've put my writing first and I schedule it for the morning, even if I'm not making huge amounts of progress, I am still checking in with it. Even if I'm just reading what I wrote again, that is still working on it, because what will happen is, okay, so I've completed my time for the day. I didn't get much of a word count. I'll go for, you know, I'll go exercise, or that night I'll take a shower. All of the answers to what I was working on earlier will come to me, and then I'll end up like dripping on my phone writing, you know, like, I have to get this sentence down. I have to get this scene. So it's still time that you're working on it, even if you can't see it immediately on the page. And to answer your other question about, you know, what I apply to it. So I am someone who likes to know how a story is going to end before I start writing it. But I'm not so rigid that I don't give my characters room. So I have kind of a loose outline of what I expect to happen. But sometimes the characters take you in other places and you just have to go with it, because they become their own people and they won't necessarily do the things that you decided were going to happen. It's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. That's sometimes how you get into a block, is if you're trying to force them into a peg where they don't fit. Let your character show you what they would do. And then, of course, there's the revision period after that. You know, like, then you're getting to take these ideas and the story that you've told yourself and make the words pretty and make sure that the structure works and, you know, try not to repeat too many words as you're saying it.
Is the book that you haven't written yet, but you know you're going to? And that's a silly question. And I don't mean what's your next book, but is this magnum opus that is going to be your defining word? This, the idea in the chrysalis has always been there, and it's, you know, at some point you're going to sit down and just write that book.
I have several books that are in my head Some of them, I, you know, like one, I have 40,000 words in notes written. Like that is a lot of just, it won't leave me alone, but I just put this thought down and I look at the file. It's like, it's 40,000 words. And I haven't written a single chapter. It's just, this is what I know about this story. So I don't really feel like any of those are the ones that you're asking. I do have a story that I feel like I should write and I don't know how to go about it yet. I've kind of hypothesized, should it be a comic book? Should it be a children's book? Should it be, I've even thought of how to make it a vampire novel since that's kind of where I live. But are you familiar with the picture of Washington crossing the Delaware? So there is, there's the boat and then there are the people on the boat with him. And the third person on the boat is actually a Black man, which people didn't know for years. And I am directly related to him, which the, I think it's the Daughters of the Revolution found my family and said, we traced your lineage back to this person. And there's so little known about him. And I feel like it's not an accident that I'm learning about this and I'm an author. It's kind of my job to tell this story, even if it's not usually the genre that I would write in. So that is the thing that I feel like I need to eventually write that story. I just don't know how to go about it yet. You know, I've said that the stories that I write tend to be about passionate women. Well, this is a man. So how am I going to tell this story and still like stick with my brand, you know what I mean? It's not just my brand. It's just, I've made a commitment to telling these stories for women because I didn't have these stories growing up. So I need to find a way to do it that works with who I am, but still honors his story.
It feels like one of those things that at some point, it'll just be the right time. And it's something will happen, something will occur, something will just trigger in the shower, exercising, whatever. And I think, oh, yeah, it's time to let that story breathe. It's time to take those 40,000 words of notes and, think about how do we, it just feels like one of those, it might be 1 year, 20 years, 50 years time, but it feels like your time will be right at some point. You mentioned then about how to represent the story, so whether it might be a comic book, a children's book, et cetera. I was reading about you co-editing Comics Lit, and that's quite different from, well, it feels quite different from being on stage and some of the writing you do. So comic books, what are your thoughts and feelings on how they represent people, individuals, beings, etc.?
Well, the whole point of Comics Lit is to share with the world how comic books are a form of high art. Not necessarily every comic book, but they have earned their place in the medium of high art. And a lot of the comic book characters that we know and love harken back to the days of classic literature, the Bible, history, and mythology. Some of them seem to be direct representations of those same characters. And now it's obvious when you look at characters like Loki and Thor. I mean, obviously, we can see the direct relationship with mythology, but one of the essays is about how Superman is essentially the story of Moses, where here's a child from a doomed home. His parents give him away, hoping that he finds a good place to live. You know, they don't even control where he's going to end up. And he ends up growing up and saving the people, rising up and saving the people. My story is how, or not story, my essay is about how Catwoman in the Batman series is essentially a reincarnation of Irene Adler from the Sherlock Holmes series, the foil to the respective detective, the one woman. He solves the crime, but she always gets away.
It's so funny. Before we talk, they just launched a new podcast in the UK, and it's the stories of Sherlock Holmes. And I was listening to that, always, I think maybe Sherlock Holmes, the first, that sounds silly, proper reading I ever did. And the Irene Adler story, how he without really, he would never use the words, I guess, fell in love with this incredibly evocative, passionate, beautiful, strong, almost dominatrix type woman in a way. But he would never use those words to describe her thing. And it was always that, I think, I always felt like he had that. Yeah, she was always the one that bested him in a way, even though, like, so he solved the case. It was almost her decision to help him solve the case. Yeah, absolutely. She got away and all those things. And I think that was always the, yeah.
And what did he take for payment in solving the case? Her picture.
Yes, I know. It could have a lot more, but it's really interesting that was, I'm sure that memory always haunted and pleased him, really. I never thought of Catwoman as being that person, but you're absolutely right. And I think there is also within the Irene Adler character and the Catwoman character, whether portrayed in film or in comic books, there's definitely a very healthy feline sexuality that character that those women had.
And certainly agency, right?
Yeah, which they would use without any shame or hesitation. It's an odd thing, but it's often in our society, women are challenged for using their sexuality. But in that particular narrative, it was a very, it sounds so silly, a very positive use of sexuality in that way, if that makes sense.
And they use it against the people who make these assumptions based on their sexuality. It's not like they are just straight out going out and seducing people. It's like, you are going to think a certain thing about me because of my appearance and my sensuality. And I'm going to use that prejudice that you have against you. That's all it is. And both of these characters in their introductions disguise themselves as not a beautiful woman. Catwoman disguises herself as an old woman, and Irene Adler disguises herself as like a kind of a boy, like a poor boy. They're just using disguises to make their way through the world and take care of themselves because there's nobody else to take care of them.
So is Catwoman your favorite comic literature character?
Definitely.
So is that Catwoman over your left shoulder?
It is. It matches the 52 Love cover, so I thought.
Yeah, no, I love the colors and the shape of everything on it. It's beautiful.
I just got that this year at Amazing Con, which is a comic con in Las Vegas. And I was looking for someone who had a booth there. You know, I had a booth there, but I was just exploring the floor. I knew that there was a local comic book store that was there, and I wanted to just go say meow. And as I was walking through, I saw this. I was like, oh, I am so drawn to that. I didn't have my phone with me. I didn't have like any money on me. It was just, I need that. And the next day I went back and said, how much is that? But she gave it to me for $25. Great.
You didn't have some sort of Catwoman type hypnotism going on, did you? Mind control. I'm like, wait, there's sometimes things find their way to the person that should have them. And it feels like that's the thing with that image, really. So do you partake in cosplay? I do.
I would say I'm an amateur cosplayer because, number one, I feel like there's a different level of cosplay when you're someone who can actually sew the costume and design it and all of that. And I don't have those skills. Like, I am not good at sewing or any of that. But I can piece together a costume based on things that other people have made. And so
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
When I do comic cons, I will usually dress as Storm or something that alludes to Catwoman, because I'll admit that being there for an 8-hour day in a cat suit and, you know, heel boots, it could be a bit uncomfortable. It's nice for photos or, you know, at home play, but not out in the world.
Do you feel different when you're in costume?
Definitely. You feel empowered. I mean, we talked earlier about how I used to be painfully shy. The first step toward getting over that, I was asked to read one of my stories at this presentation in front of all of these people. And it's like, oh, it's one thing to have your story out in the world. It is quite another to be up there reading it to someone. And I didn't know how I was going to get through it. And so I dressed like the character, because she is bold and powerful and just, she's just spectacular. And I thought, if I slip into her skin, I don't have to be scared. And that's what I did. And so underneath the dress, I was terrified, but nobody there knew. Even the people who knew me said they didn't recognize it. They didn't know. So I started doing that every time. It's like, you know what? I will just always be my characters, because they are always braver than I am.
It's funny, isn't it? I was talking to I'm not sure how she would define herself. Maybe a sexologist, maybe, a few months ago. And she was talking about when people role play or bring cosplay characters into their relationships, how difficult that makes things feel. Sometimes it might be in a relationship. It might be, who knows, 5 years, 20 years. And you might be doing and saying and feeling the same things you felt for, which is not a bad thing, but it's just something about role play or cosplay when you get into the character, it just feels so, so different. And almost like, yeah, there were two different people involved in it. And I don't know whether that's because people bring out something in themselves that they don't normally show or share, or they're just, like you say, just like you said, maybe just feel more confident in playing this character as opposed to being themselves.
That's actually one of the tips in 52 Love, is to explore with cosplay. And then there's another tip that is about fantasy play, a little bit different. But yeah, I definitely recommend some form of cosplay with relationships. And even if it's not in the bedroom, what if you just want to go out and pretend like you're these two different characters in the world? You know, there are people who will pick each other up. You know, you're already in a committed relationship, but then you'll go someplace and you'll pretend like you don't know each other. So you'll get that thrill of meeting a new person and hitting it off, and the banter that happens with new people, with new play. And you may not know who this person is going to be when you get there. Like, you recognize their face, but they get to explore a different personality while you're playing a different role. And so it's fun. It keeps things fresh and interesting. And then you can carry it back into the bedroom.
Yeah, I like the idea of meeting my partner in a hotel bar, not knowing each other, and just casually sliding my room key across.
Right. So,
she probably slided it back to say, what was this? But yes, it's nice, because you date somebody in the beginning, then you're in a relationship, and that almost that slightly awkward dating bit goes away, which is good in a way, I guess. But you do miss that frisson or just excitement of not quite knowing where something's going to go or how it's going to go, etc. So in 52 Love, so you very kindly distill romance into these, I guess, sort of on the vampire theme, bite-sized lessons. So are there...
That was not even on purpose, but I should say, thank you for noticing that.
Was it almost a case of, were you almost trying to cram them in? You think, oh my gosh, I've got too many now? Or was it, oh gosh, I've got 10, I need to find 42 more. Was it, how did the ideas and...
It started out as a blog. It wasn't like I never had a book in mind. I was just trying to put something out in the world. I was just trying to be disciplined to make sure that I was writing regularly and putting something to page at least once a week and then posting it to my blog. And then it ended up becoming, I wouldn't say so popular, but people were engaging with it. People were responding to it either on the website or they were writing me. And people started asking me for a book. So I was like, okay, well, maybe I should do this. And I should say that I was doing this during 2020. So when I started this project, things were fine. You know, I wouldn't say fine, but, you know, like we didn't have any idea what was about to happen. And then you get to around June and, oh my gosh, I am not sure I should still be writing this blog about love, you know? Like people are dying and there's the George Floyd thing. And I was like, what am I doing? And I'm going to sit down and still do this blog about love. Like, am I ignoring what's going on? Is it insensitive to keep doing this? Does it even matter? And just out of nowhere, I started getting messages on the website, people responding to the blog, emails, text messages. I never said this out loud. I never asked the question out loud, like, why am I even doing this? And yet the world just started telling me, please keep doing this. It's something to look forward to. Thank you for putting something positive in the world. People who weren't in relationships were messaging me. And so, okay, this is my contribution. I'm giving people like blog size break from the chaos in the world. And by the end of 2020, I ended up having an agent who said that she thought that we could turn this into a book. And so I started a podcast called the 52 Love Podcast. The year after that, 2021, I had one guest per week for an entire year. They would try one of the tips from the blog with their partner and then come on and talk about how it went. And then they would get to promote whatever creative thing they did. So I had authors and publishers and photographers and, you know, actors and just whatever kind of creative person was on there, some artists as well. But it was a very fun experience. And I learned some things talking to these different people. It's like, okay, these are my tips, but some of them were taking these tips to a new level. And it just shows you the power of collaboration, the power of making sure that you include a giant sample size when you're, you know, when you're trying to come up with an opinion on something. One voice is not necessarily the best choice. And then by the end of that, I think, by the end of 2021, I think, is when I signed with Four Horsemen. And we were actually doing it for Comics Lit, but they asked, what else do you have? And so I talked to them about 52 Love, and they're like, we would love to do that.
Did you have a favorite?
I have a few favorites. So I really love cosplay. So I appreciate that one. I've done a lot of research when it comes to romantic. How do I say this? I used to work at a market research firm, and it was very weird that there was a chair in front of my desk where people would come and sit and talk to me about their problems. It wasn't part of my job officially, but they called it the therapy chair because people have just always shared their stories with me and asked me for advice. And so I started doing research to make sure that I was giving good answers. It's like I felt a responsibility to these people who were trusting me with their problems and their stories. And so I started reading and learning to be able to give better advice. And one of the books that I read was The Five Love Languages. Now, looking back on it, I know that it is very, it's homophobic. It is sexist. Like there are just some cringy elements to it. But the point stands that there really are five love languages and that. So I think that the way it's presented is a little cringy, but the points stand. Like, that there really are these love languages, and it has helped me to understand even my own relationships better. I've had family members that I thought did not care about me at all, and that book helped me to recognize, you know, it's not even a romantic relationship. It's just, oh, this person has just been loving me in a way that doesn't make sense to me, and I've been ignoring all of that love, thinking that they're not loving me. So I'm also hurting them by not appreciating all of this that they're doing. Like, I'm not a gifts person. I appreciate gifts, but it's not the thing that makes me feel loved. And they're just lavishing me with gifts that I'm like, will you just like listen to me and pay attention to me? But now I know. And now I would say that was probably the most valuable tip. And it's not even mine. It's just one that I'm passing on, because it has definitely helped with multiple relationships. There, you know, there've been new babies in the family where I can be like, oh, that's, you could see how this baby is responding already. Like, this is definitely not just all babies like this. This is, that one in particular seems to be lighting up for this particular love language. So it's been very useful.
No, I think it's a great book. And I think for people that haven't seen it yet, shame on you, but go out and buy it.
Just keep in mind, it's very heteronormative, and you know, it's very sexist. It's misogynist, because even like the example stories, you're like, oh, was it?
What I was going to say, I think a lot of the things you talk about in there aren't necessarily just things that are relevant within a sexual relationship.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the five love languages. I made it for to not make mine heteronormative. So
I'm sure it wasn't how I read it, but I'm like, okay, it's your book.
Thank you.
No, and I was going to say, because I think one of the earliest tips is about communication, and it's a real, real bugbear of mine that I think we have this amazing ability to connect with people pretty much anywhere in the world. You're in Vegas right now. I'm in London. We're talking quite easily. And it's not difficult at all. So we have this amazing ability to connect with people everywhere. But we seem to be at a time in society where we are perhaps less connected than ever before. I think almost because of this amazing smartphone technology device or whatever we have that are always within arm's reach, that they're always there. And I've walked into rooms before, sat in restaurants with people, and lunch around the tables, and people are just on their phones. I'm not sure whether they're messaging each other. I'm sure they're not, but it's basically saying that to the person you're with,
there's stuff more interesting to you.
Exactly.
Things that you're creating, work, whatever.
Either more interesting or more important than you. That's what it's saying. There's something more interesting or more important than you.
Well, somehow, they have 15 minutes, often they're not an hour of a good rest day to actually walk with into a partner's. Yeah, I'm running their phone, but I'm looking at our phones.
Right. My phone's not even open.
Well, no, mine's in the kitchen, which is good, and intentionally. And I think, yeah, sometimes I just worry that couples come home on their phone, they look at their phone, they have dinner looking at their phone, they get to bed. Yes, they might have sex, but they probably roll over when they finish and check their phone. And you think, oh my goodness, just this ability to communicate does feel like a big gap. And I do worry about that lack of communication.
I do as well. And I see the same thing when you go to a restaurant. You're just like, they're both like, they're right there, but they're both engaged elsewhere. I do have an unplugging tip too. Like, that is one of them, where you make a date of it. You put your phone elsewhere, silence it, turn it off, put it in another room so you're not even tempted to reach for it, and just do something together without having your phone right there.
Most of the happy memories we have, whether in relationships, by ourselves, whatever, don't involve our phones. They really don't. It can be something tiny that we love for the moment. It can be seeing something in nature. It can be reading something, whatever. It generally isn't something on our smartphone. So the answer to all of what ails the world isn't to be found in our devices, I'm sure. One of the other tips you mentioned, and it did make me laugh in a way, because I talked to somebody else about something similar, was, I'm not sure how to phrase it, the use of erotic or naughty, dirty language in the bedroom, maybe. And sorry. And I was talking to somebody, and they were saying, oh my God, I was with my partner. It was a lady telling me that. And that partner asked, just talk to her, to me. And she said he sort of struggled for a little while, and then he just shouted out random words. He obviously had no idea what he's doing. He was like, bitch. And he's like, what are you doing? That's not what I want at all. He just hadn't the language in that moment.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
So thankfully, they both sort of burst that laughing, and it was just, yeah. So I do think maybe prepare yourself a little bit. And what words some people like, some people don't like. But it was just so funny the way she sort of said it. It was like, you're lucky he had Tourette's. He just shattered all his profanities. It was like, okay, that's not best. It's not really doing it for me. But
at least they could communicate that, you know? It's like, okay, so you tried it. That wasn't right. They have a laugh about it. Try it again.
Yeah, it was very funny. So tell me a little bit more about the vampire side of your life.
Oh, I don't know what I can share on your show. Let's just say that I've had a long, loving relationship with vampires. I've never been afraid of them. When, you know, kids would go to sleep and, you know, wait to be like this to make sure that nothing gets made. I would be like, I have extra neck if anyone's curious. Dracula is one of my crushes. I have a crush on Batman, a crush on Loki, and Dracula. Like, those are my three big crushes. And the Gary Oldman Dracula, he was just fantastic. And so my first manuscript, I decided I was not going to write about vampires because I didn't think it was serious literature. You know, I was very new and like, oh, I want to write something very serious. So I'm going to write about this. Really, it came to me in a dream. So it's not like I had decided what I was going to write anyway, but the characters hadn't presented as vampires. And I wrote this story. And when my agent who took 52 Love started, you know, she ended up taking my fiction as well. And she's like, we're getting feedback that one of the characters seems like a vampire. It's like, oh no, I very specifically did not make him a vampire. You know, I told my brother and he's like, they're all vampires. You don't have to say it. And so, okay. So one of the editors even called my agent three chapters in. It's like, you didn't tell me this was a vampire novel. And she's like, it's not. But she thought, now is the time I better like check in with Tanya and say, hey, this the feedback we're getting. And so I took the manuscript with an eye of what if. Okay, so what if it is? What if I want to turn it into a vampire novel? What do I need to do? And I realized that, oh my gosh, it is a vampire novel. It's all through here. Like, just so many elements of vampire lore were in it without me even attempting. All I had to do was add blood. It was already there. And so it's like, I have decided to stop trying to fit into whatever box I thought I needed to fit into at the time, and just let my characters take me where they go. And it's made for better stories. There's something about vampire stories that allows us to indulge in more passion with fewer rules. You know, if some of these characters did the things that happen in vampire novels in real life, there would be all kinds of red flags, and you'd be like, hey, that's not okay. But when it's a vampire, it's sexy.
No.
They allow you to let go of your inhibitions and kind of indulge in some of your secret passions and fascinations. And I love that.
I remember reading some of the Hannah Rice novels when I was younger. And feeling that they were more erotic than anything else. And her character, Lestat, and I remember being, I loved, you're going to hate me for this. But hear me out. I loved Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but for the vampires.
Are you talking about the movie or the show?
And the series.
Okay, I loved the series too.
You had them.
I didn't want to watch it because of the title, and I had a friend who's like, just try it. And the first season was a bit.
Yeah. And there were some very odd episodes in there. There was the musical episode, which was very odd. There were some really weird. But I thought when the things that happened to Spike and to Angel and things, it just first of all, as a heterosexual man, I'm very happy to say how beautiful both Spike, James Masters, and Angel are. Is stunning big people. Absolutely, it's stunning. And it's funny, I rewatched an episode the other day, and it was fabulous. And I think that whole vampire thing, but I do think it's very clear where the eroticism comes from, I guess, that sharing in somebody's blood is probably the most passionate thing you can do, I would have thought.
It's an exchange of fluids, right? And it's not just fluid, it's their life source.
It is. I mean, it's penetration, but with our teeth into somebody's neck. And the whole thing about kissing somebody's neck, and you have a very bicycle neck, by the way, which we know. But it is, isn't it? It's very much you're penetrating the skin. There's something about the color of blood. It's incredibly beautiful. It's incredibly. That's why so many, erotic images use the color red, because it's the color of blood and it's the color of intimacy and so many things. And even when.
And think about the places that they bite. It's like the erogenous zones, it's the wrist, it's here, behind the knee, like all these places that you like to be kissed.
I felt my ouch.
I'm working on a Dracula retelling right now from Mina Murray's perspective, so that it's still kind of... I am 92,000 words into it, really close to the end. And then, I have to do the deep dive into all of the revisions. It's a massive undertaking because I've never done historical fiction. So it's not just telling the story. I need to build this world and show what life was like at the time. And in doing so, I'm doing all this research about the time and seeing these connections to... oddly to Jane Austen's world, which even though Dracula was in the Victorian era and Jane Austen was long before that in the Regency era, there are some elements like to Mansfield Park, and Elizabeth Dido Bell has a connection too. It's like, I'm seeing all of these things, the Murray name. It's like, wow, I didn't know there were going to be all of these layers, but I'm here for it. I just need to untangle those layers so that I make it clear to the readers the significance of all of these things happening while still telling a good vampire story.
But it is the sort of tradition of the gothic vampire from when Bram Stoker first put the words down. It was always very much this nobleman, this amazing castle, it was never a poverty-stricken Dracula. So you had that sort of, that thing that very much crosses over with you know, what Jane Austen was doing about the big country houses and the parties they had. And you can imagine their sort of almost bacchanalian feasts that Dracula would have loved. Whatever in his world, really. It's, yeah. No, so I'm not putting anyone in any time pressure, but when's it going to be finished?
I am hoping to finish the first draft by the end of next month. And then it's going to take me some time to revise it longer than a contemporary novel, just because I have to make sure that I get the details of the world right.
But if you ever want an outside pair of eyes on him, have a quick look. I'm very happy to be here.
We'll take you up on that.
Really?
Yes.
I would love to see it. And when you're writing a book like that, that obviously is based on something that other people have had experience on, other people have views on, when do you know, this is alluding to say, but almost, when do you know when it's finished?
When it's in print. Because I'm a compulsive editor. Every time I look at something, I edit it. If I am doing a public reading, I have even edited something that's on the page, that's already in print, it's already finished. But even then, I have been known to be like, oh, this would be a better word now. Because, you know, I evolve as a writer. So, of course, I'm thinking I have more. You have a cat going in. A dog going out.
My son has just come out, so now the dog's wondering, why is only one person here? So what do you think the future holds for you now? So once this book is done and it's in print and people are looking to read it, what comes next for you?
Diving into one of the next stories. I have a whole list of stories that are begging for my attention. And, you know, as I said, I have these files where it's like, okay, I'm just going to put this here so I don't lose the thought. I have another story that I'm in revisions for that I need to get back to my agent. And I do have that original novel that turned out to be a vampire story that is on submission right now. So I hope to just continue the cycle of creating art. I have a film that I'm hoping to have in the festival circuit next year. Shocker, it's a vampire story.
All right, well, you know.
Exactly.
Do you intentionally give yourself downtime and time to re-energize? And it feels like you have so many plates you're spinning and balls you're juggling, whatever the metaphor.
I will admit I am terrible at like giving myself downtime, and I'm better about it now. But I wouldn't say that I have found like the perfect balance yet. I did allow myself an actual vacation this year. But even at the end of it, I did a Comic-Con. It's like I went to Oregon to visit my brother. And the last 2 days I did a Comic-Con in his city. So it was a business trip, but I did allow myself that week to just, you know, we went ATV riding and we did some hiking and we went to 2 plays and we went to see a movie. And I spent a lot of time just enjoying his company. I had a family member in town yesterday. Mondays are usually my big writing day, like where I just block off the biggest amount of time. It's weird. Mondays are my favorite day of the week because I do the most writing. But I decided I would just do the minimum amount where I wasn't going to be like stuck in my story all day. And then I spent the day watching movies. So I do give myself downtime, but I know that I don't give myself enough. I am so wrapped up in banned books right now between reading the books and recording the episodes. I have 10 scheduled recordings just this month between banned books and all the other things that I'm doing. That's a lot. Like that's so many per week. And I'm doing a Comic-Con. So in October, I have decided I'm going to take 2 weeks and just not do any outside media, just stay at home. I'm very much introverted. I'm going to keep to myself and replenish that energy. I'll still be working because it brings me joy to write. But that's for me. I don't consider it rest, but it's definitely nourishment. And staying home and preserving my energy, that's going to be how I kind of heal from all of the activity that I have scheduled for this month.
Well, the film festival brings you back to the UK and you and your kids come to London. I'd love to meet you in person. I have to ask my final question. It's a very frivolous question. But the nails?
My nails?
Yeah.
It's very well,
poison,
okay.
Poison ivy color.
That family member that was here yesterday, her birthday is this month, and green is her favorite color. So I
guess a blood red lipstick and poison ivy nails. It's perfect.
They're called cat's eye nails, and you know I'm Catwoman, so I. But I didn't do my nails for years. It was when I started acting. My second job was a SAG project, and you have to go and do makeup and hair ahead of filming. You know, they have to do the fitting and make sure, you know, they make a decision about what they're going to do. Do they have the right foundation for you? And there's actually a project called Show Dogs. And they said, could you do something with your nails? Because my nails were just, they were always breaking. And I noticed that once I did my nails, they stopped breaking. And so I keep them polished because they don't break as much. And now they're pretty.
Yeah, very lovely. Another part of the beautiful year, you see. Thank you. Well, thank you, Sam. I must feel bad now that I've taken some of your time now. But I, being selfish, I really, really enjoyed it.
I did as well. Like network. I feel like we made a real connection. And when I come back to the UK, I have another person to visit.
Absolutely. You 100% do. Yeah, my daughter family would love you. I know my daughter has a passion for this sort of romanticy, fantasy type novel. And anything like that should be.
I'll send you some recommendations.
Oh, please do. Because she's going through a phase now rereading things. She said, well, I'm sort of scared to try something new in case I don't love it as much. And I'll reread it. He read that one sort of four times.
But, you know, I know
so,
that feeling.
I used to do the same. But never recommendations. I do look forward to reading your work when it comes out.
To meet you in person.
I definitely think that's going to happen.
Excellent. Thank you.
My pleasure.